Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claus. Enjoy.
Amanda Ellis is the Director of Global Partnerships for the Arizona State University Julie Ann Wrigley Global Futures Laboratory. Previously a New Zealand ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations in Geneva, Ms. Ellis also served as Prime Minister's special envoy, playing a key role in New Zealand's successful UN Security Council bid, the author of two best-selling Random House business books, and several research articles on gender and growth in the World Bank Directions in Development series. Ms. Ellis is a founding member of the Global Banking Alliance for Women and a recipient of the TIAW Lifetime Achievement Award for services to women's economic empowerment. She serves on a number of boards, including the Global Governance Forum. Thank you so much for agreeing to participate in this interview, Amanda. We're delighted you can talk to us. You have been at the forefront of promoting gender equality and women's economic empowerment, and have an established background working with some of the institutions that have made significant strides towards that goal. So it has been 25, perhaps a little more, years since the Beijing Platform for Action was agreed to at the Fourth World Congress on Women in 1995, where the international community renewed its commitment to advance the goals of equality, development, and peace for all women everywhere. 25 years later, what has the international community accomplished in terms of achieving greater gender equality? Where has it failed to act and why?
Well, thank you, Augusto. It's a great pleasure to be with you. And I think the international community has continued to set expectations through the Millennial Development Goals, specifically number 3, on the empowerment of women and girls in 2000. And that, of course, was also the year where the UN Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace, and security was unanimously agreed by the Security Council. In 2010, we had the creation of UN Women to bring together across the entire UN system all of the bodies dealing with gender equality issues. And in 2015, for the first time in global history and her story, we had unanimous agreement on sustainable development goals. And of those 17, number 5 deals with gender equality and the empowerment of women and girls. So we can certainly see that there is no lack of continuing milestones to attempt to move forward on gender equality. What is so disappointing, Augusto, is that here we are in 2021 and not a single country has yet achieved full gender equality in practice. And I think what is even worse is only 10, according to the latest Women, Business and the Law data sets, have even fully legislated for it. So we certainly have a long way to go. When we look at governance, we have made progress and there are more women now in parliaments than there have been before, 1 in 4, but less than 5% of parliaments have reached gender parity, which was an aim of ECOSOC way back in 2000. We know too that the private sector is beginning to step up and create impetus for positions for more women on boards, etc., and documenting the diversity dividend around that. But of course, the gender pay gap is still significant. And finally, when we look at attitudes and surveys like the World Value Survey, which we used, and the Reykjavik Women's Leadership Index, we can really see that there is a long way to go in terms of changing attitudes towards gender equality. So On the positive side of the ledger, the international community has continued to set down markers and to measure progress. On the negative side of the ledger, the progress has been, in my view, I would use the word pitiful.
In addition to the Beijing platform, let's discuss other initiatives adopted by the international community, including the UN Convention to End All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Many have argued that this convention has been a powerful instrument to encourage countries to give greater attention to gender equality and the role of women in promoting economic and social development. In fact, I remember once looking at the Women, Business and the Law data some years ago and noticing that 5 years after countries had adopted the convention, you could actually see a reduction in the number of discriminations that were embedded in the law, in the laws of that particular country. And yet, women are still lagging behind. Do we have to wait another century or two for all countries to be rich and prosperous before we can claim victory on the achievement of gender equality?
Well, Augusto, I couldn't agree more that CEDAW, which was adopted in 1979 by the UN General Assembly, has been a very important mechanism. And if we look at the number of countries that have ratified, it's 189, which is just shy of the 193 UN member countries. But 59 states still have reservations. And I think that's an important area to focus on. Now, CEDAW is often described as the International Bill of Rights for Women because it defines gender discrimination and sets up agendas for national action. So we know that states that ratify CEDAW do commit to incorporating the principle of gender equality in their legislation and abolishing all discriminatory laws. And part of the thinking behind Women, Business and the Law was to measure in a very transparent way to be able to elicit the kind of information that you've just cited, which is indeed positive. And then the other important element of CEDAW was to establish tribunals and public institutions to ensure protection against discrimination. And countries that have ratified the convention must submit national reports every 4 years on their compliance. So it is an important mechanism for continuing to focus on this critical issue. But you do point out that it is going to still take quite some time. And in fact, with the pandemic, when we look at the latest World Economic Forum Global Gender Gap report, the amount of time estimated for us to reach full gender equality has gone up from almost 100 years, another full generation, to almost 137 years. So the impact of COVID has really in many ways, taken us backwards. And I think you and I would agree that 137 years is indeed not an acceptable data point.
Indeed, indeed. In fact, you mentioning COVID prompts me to ask the next question. And it's basically to do with the role gender has played in the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. How have women been impacted by COVID-19, and what factors explain that the effects of the pandemic have been very asymmetric, with women being disproportionately affected? Additionally, there is a robust body of evidence that shows that countries led by women account for a large share of the cases of successful management of the pandemic. Why do you think this is the case? What lessons can leaders around the world take from these women world leaders?
I do think that that has been a very positive story. But to begin with the impact of COVID-19 on women, those marginalized groups have been really hit the hardest. And women in particular, in fact, many economists are calling this a she session rather than a recession, a she session, because these existing inequalities have been exacerbated. Not only are women the majority of frontline workers in terms of healthcare and the service economy, which has been so hard hit, but also the majority of caregivers. And while in developed countries, it has been possible for many workers to migrate online, for those who have caregiver duties, whether it be for children at school and having to supervise them, or for elderly parents, the majority of that triple bind has fallen on women. We know too that there has been a very worrying spike in domestic violence, and that is important not only from a human rights and moral perspective, but also from an economic perspective. In the US alone, the estimate is that the rise in violence is costing some $460 billion a year, which is more than any other crime. And we know too from work recently done by McKinsey that on the flip side, if we are able to have a gender-informed recovery, their estimate is that $13 trillion could be added to the global economy by 2030. In Hawaii, where I reside, there is actually a feminist recovery plan that has been put forward. And I think this is a wonderful example to other states and countries. Now, you mentioned the success rate of many women leaders in dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. And in fact, the data was really quite startling that some 8% of women world leaders, that some 8% of leaders who are women were responsible for 40% of the positive responses to COVID. And we can really see a number of reasons for that. First of all, the paramount importance given to privileging human well-being. Second, listening to scientists. And we saw in great contrast to some of the authoritarian male leaders around the world who tended to go on gut instinct and in some cases actively dismiss the scientists' perspective with very detrimental outcomes. And that was a big contrast with women leaders who were collaborating and really listening to the scientists in their countries. They were also communicating very clearly. And in my own country, New Zealand, my country of birth, our Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern was nightly on social media to speak to what she called our team of 5 million, the whole population, and to explain very clearly that while it was, of course, difficult for everybody to be in early lockdown to try to combat community transmission, it was very clear why we needed to do it. We needed to do it to save lives and for others in the community. So it was a very collective approach that was communicated and a compassionate approach. And I loved the quote that Jacinda, as we New Zealanders like to call her, made about the importance of being both kind and strong, and pointing out that those two qualities are not mutually exclusive, but in fact can be mutually reinforcing to the benefit of populations. And I'm currently in New Zealand, where my mother is unfortunately very ill in hospital. And New Zealand has done such a good job of containing community transmission cases that apart from having to wear masks on public transport, of course, on flights, the community is very much operating as normal and using an app, a tracing app, to sign in wherever one goes so that in the case of an outbreak, it is possible to trace that. So I think that this has been quite a startling contrast, seeing the women leaders in New Zealand and Taiwan and Singapore, in Germany, in Denmark, in Finland, really seeing those examples and the traits that they have in common in dealing with the pandemic.
Yes, the data is very compelling. I agree with you. And it raises really fundamental questions about the costs that we bear as a society by the fact that women are still underrepresented at the very high levels of power in the world. No, it's a very sobering piece of information that I think should lead to a lot of reflection and soul searching. Amanda, earlier in your career, while you were at the World Bank, you collaborated with the Economist Intelligence Unit in producing the Women's Economic Empowerment Index and founded the Women, Business and the Law Project, which led to the creation of an extremely valuable data set on gender discriminations embedded in the laws of countries around the world. More recently, you have worked with the Global Governance Forum to produce the Gender Equality and Governance Index, tapping into an array of data to identify best practices and gaps or weaknesses in 158 countries in respect of the achievement of gender equality. How can such an index be put to good use to catalyze progress in the economic and political empowerment of women?
Well, this is one of my favorite topics, Augusto, as you know, and I think it's so important to have transparent data to be able to raise awareness in the first instance. And I think I was rather naive when we began the project at the World Bank because I thought that as soon as everybody saw the data, there would be an immediate rush to transform laws. And we have seen that while 10 countries now have full gender equality under the law, it has been a slow process. So the work that we have collaborated on with the Gender Equality and Governance Index is so important in terms of being able to look at the critical pillars. And we selected governance, education, paid work, entrepreneurship, and violence as the pillars that we felt were really important to bring together a range of different transparent data sets and then to be able to investigate the correlations. And from that, to spur action. And I think for me, one of the very important findings that you hinted at earlier was that when we see more women in governance positions, we see greater attention to factors like girls' education, family nutrition and welfare, which we know have a positive intergenerational multiplier impact. And we also see, interestingly, a couple of studies now from the International Finance Corporation and Foreign Policy demonstrating that the very important issue of climate change and sustainability, which really, in my view, is now the number one crisis that we are grappling with, are more likely to be paid attention to and to be brought into legal and regulatory mechanisms if there are more women. And I think this is just, this was such an important finding for us. So that kind of correlation and being able to spur action and change are really critical. And then, of course, to measure outcomes on a regular basis. And I'm just thrilled that we will be able to regularly update the Global Gender Equality and Governance Index to act as a positive tool for policymakers and indeed for the UN system, the multilateral development banks, and for the private sector.
Amanda, if we can sort of look ahead, I would be very interested in hearing you comment on what are some of the biggest challenges facing women today. We seem to have made some progress in recent decades in the integration of women into higher education and the professions. As you noted earlier on, there are more women parliamentarians than at any point in the past, one in four, at least since we began to collect such data. And yet, the data compiled in the Gender Equality and Governance Index can also be seen from a perspective of a glass half empty, as people say, with multiple forms of discrimination still part of the everyday reality faced by women and girls nearly everywhere. In fact, I wonder whether Sustainable Development Goal number 5 is achievable within the next decade, as we had hoped. COVID-19 has shown how quickly the progress made can be reversed, with large increases last year seen in the number of women falling below the extreme poverty line, and as resurgent, as you also noted, of violence against women?
There are so many challenges, but I would rank them, leadership and governance, as the most critical issues for some of the reasons we've discussed and the correlations that are now emerging between having more women in governance positions in the private sector as well as the public sector. And indeed, the diversity dividend is now well documented. The Peterson Institute did a very large longitudinal study and showed that in the private sector, having more women on boards and in senior management correlates with a 6% higher return on investment. So, of course, that's good for everybody. And we hear about the war for talent, of course, too. Now, as you know, my bias is that legal equality is a necessary but not sufficient condition. And I found that very much working in the field, being able to join the dots. So for example, one of my early trips when I first joined the World Bank back in 2003 was to East Africa. And I still recall very vividly working with women in Kenya who were extremely well educated. They had master's degrees, but they joined the dots for me by explaining to me why, without the legal right to own property at that time, it impacted their safety in the home in terms of the impunity with which their husbands could beat them. It also meant that they were left with nothing if their husbands were to divorce them. And of course, that correlated with the rate of HIV/AIDS in Africa being 5 times higher for women than for men in that age group, late teens to 35. And of course, it directly impacted their ability to be economically active in the private sector too, because without collateral for a business loan, women were really stuck in microfinance circles rather than being able to advance and grow their businesses. So we've seen some very encouraging developments as laws have been updated and changed. And right through Latin America, as you know, there have been many countries now that have implemented laws of violence against women. That is a necessary but insufficient condition, as I said, because we still need to look at attitudinal change and how our institutions, like the judiciary and the police, interpret those laws. But that would be my hierarchy, the leadership and governance issues, the importance of legal equality as a baseline, and then how that leads to safety in the home, economic participation, and activity. And of course, the other interesting dimension for that is that we are now looking at the importance of circular economy, regenerative models, and for-purpose as well as for-profit businesses. Women are more likely to be social entrepreneurs and to have those kinds of businesses, which are particularly critical in this next decade. As the Oceans icon Sylvia Earle reminds us, this coming decade is the most important in the next 10,000 because of the very high level of greenhouse gases and the impact that that is having on our planetary boundaries too. So I think, again, having women bring in new and innovative business models and being able to take those to scale is really critical from a planetary perspective as well. Augusto, I just wanted to remind you of the work that we have going on at the ASU Julianne Wrigley Global Futures Laboratory in partnership with the Global Governance Forum to really make it easier for a whole range of people to be engaged in a process of advocacy for change. So we know that the Human Rights Council Universal Periodic Review reviews all UN member countries every 3 to 5 years, depending on how large the country is, and that this happens in a public forum at the Human Rights Council in Geneva. Now, when I was ambassador, you and I worked closely together to try to raise the awareness of the ambassadors there and also to bring in civil society groups who could help advocate for change. And now I'm thrilled that in working with some of our brilliant students at our high-tech luminosity lab, we have actually been able to develop an interactive map. So you can click on any country and you can see a summary which our partners, World Bank, Women, Business and the Law team have done to actually go through a woman's life cycle from birth to pension and look at the key issues where there are still laws outstanding that need to be changed. And then if you want to sign up for a notification mechanism, 1 year before your country or any country that you're interested in is going to be reviewed in the Human Rights Council, you will get a push notification with the summary and a link to the map so you can explore other good practices, both in your region and globally. And we're just delighted that we have a broader partnership now with the UN Foundation to help work with an advocacy campaign for youth. So I think that that is a really exciting part of our collaboration in terms of taking this data and really being able to empower a much broader global audience wanting to engage in a practical way with policymakers both nationally and in the context of the Universal Periodic Review at the Human Rights Council.
Very interesting and very encouraging as well. Amanda, let's shift gears a little bit, and I wanted to talk about the role of women in security issues. You know, there's a great deal of concern today about the resurgence of militarism. People are asking themselves whether we haven't entered a new arms race. And you see the kind of language that is being used in the media and in policymaking circles that has an underpinning of hostility and tension, political tension. That reminds me a little bit of sort of the period leading to the end of the Cold War in the late 80s. A few years back, I read a fascinating account of the role of women in Ireland, how they had a very successful role in the negotiation of the Good Friday Agreement, which brought peace to the country after more than 30 years of violence and suffering. Protestant and Catholic women joined forces. They secured for themselves a seat at the table and were instrumental in refocusing the content of the negotiations from issues of borders, of weapons, of who was guilty for what on what day, the allocation of blame for past tragedies, to issues of education, public health, economic opportunities, you know, particularly for the young and the children. What does this tell us about the vital role that women can play in bringing about a more peaceful world? Not only when we contemplate the presence of unresolved conflicts around the world, but also the possible reemergence of this arms race, which seems to be underway today.
This is such an important question, Augusto. And it was a great victory when UN Security Council Resolution 1325 was passed unanimously. And we know the background with Namibia and the women who actually led that initiative. So I think the example that you've given of Ireland is a particularly salient one because women civil society actors were very engaged in the process, as well as women parliamentarians and groups like Vital Voices Global Partnership, which continues to play an important role globally, engaged very actively. And interestingly, when we look at other examples, for example, Rwanda, the Solomon Islands, where there had been cases of civil war, and the critical role that women were able to play in really bringing people together to heal. You may have seen the film by Walt Disney's granddaughter, Abigail Disney, about the civil war in Liberia called Pray the Devil Back to Hell, which is a wonderful insight into the role that women played with their strike, their husbands, and then making sure that those who were in charge of peacekeeping were not actually allowed to leave until they came up with positive solutions. So I think there have been a number of very interesting cases over the years where women have been able to come together in quite different forms and groups to influence these processes. And of course, within the UN context, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which is now over 100 years old, has played a critical role. In my own experience with Syria, it was the group of women ambassadors and heads of agency in Geneva who worked actively with the International League to ensure that we could bring women in to the table to speak with the special envoy, de Mistura. And so from my own experience too, women have been very much at the forefront of collaborating. And I do agree with you, we are at a critical juncture where the discourse is becoming much more polarized. And I think it is absolutely critical for us to continue to pay attention to the provisions of UNSC 1325, where not only is the disproportionate impact of armed conflict on women recognized, but the critical dimension of women's empowerment in the process through conflict prevention, peacekeeping. And of course, we've seen women peacekeeping at the force from India, which was so impactful, conflict resolution and peace building. So I guess I would sum it up in three P's: that protection, knowing that women are disproportionately impacted, women and girls and children, and then the role that women can play in prevention, and then the importance of their ongoing participation in healing post-conflict.
Yes, yes. You know, I was reading not long ago an account of how the nations of Europe a little more than 100 years ago got involved in World War One. And one of the things that struck me really was the callousness, the indifference shown by essentially male political leaders at the time of the various nations that ultimately were engulfed in that conflict for the young, for their sons, for the boys that were sent off to war in defense of some nationalistic, patriotic ideal. And it sort of brought home to me the need and the importance of accelerating the political empowerment of women, because I think that they will redress some of the imbalance which we have seen over the many past decades, you know, that has led to needless violence and death and suffering for countless millions. Amanda, I wanted to give you the last word, and in particular, I wanted to ask you whether you could comment on how can the private sector actors, you know, help further the goals of gender equality and women's economic empowerment. How can young people in particular be involved in this change and push for a brighter tomorrow? You know, the Global Governance Forum has more than 100,000 followers that are under the age of 24. How can they guard against the gender prejudices that were one of the defining characteristics of their parents and grandparents?
Such great questions. And I think to begin with the private sector, in many ways, elements of the private sector have been ahead of governments. So, for example, if we look at the recent work that's been done on the diversity dividend, and we see that some firms are now stepping up to say, if there are not women in leadership positions on the board, for example, we're not going to invest. And we've seen Goldman Sachs come out and say that. One initiative I'm particularly excited about is the We Empower United Nations Sustainable Development Goal Challenge, and WE stands for Women Entrepreneurs. This challenge was launched by the Secretary General and the president of the World Bank, along with the Council of Women World Leaders, at the UN General Assembly in New York in 2018. And the idea is to really shine a spotlight to honor those women around the world who are coming up with innovative approaches to helping create the world we want by 2030 and to fulfill the SDG agenda. It's also an opportunity to invest in them because there are still so many challenges, as we've discussed, for women operating in the private sector, and to create a positive multiplier impact for change. As Maya Angelou says, you can't be what you can't see, and it's so important to create role models. There's a wonderful story from our first elected woman Prime Minister, Helen Clark, who said that after 7 years in government, she was speaking to a primary school audience, and one of the little boys put his hand up and said, "Prime Minister Clark, is it possible for boys to become prime ministers too?" And she chuckled and said, "Well, of course," but it really brought home to her the importance of having role models. And in New Zealand, we have had three prime ministers now, and it's only New Zealand and Finland who have had three women leaders. So really the importance of role modeling is a really critical one, and another reason that I'm so thrilled to be collaborating on the Gender Equality and Governance Index, which comes up with a lot of new data sets on women as central bank governors, for example, in the judiciary, on the Supreme Court. And so really being able to find out just how many women have been in those leadership positions so that we will be able to work with those data sets and come up with some interesting correlations in the future. But when we look at the fact that fully one third of global companies still have not a single woman on their boards, we realize that there does need to be legislative change and attitudinal change. And sometimes the legislative change can prompt the attitudinal change. And I would give the example of Norway, which back in 2003 made an announcement that publicly listed boards needed to have 40% of women on the boards within a particular time frame. And there was a great hue and cry that it would be impossible to find the women, etc. And yet that was achieved, and very successfully. And out of that original leadership from the Norwegian government, we saw the studies and the correlations showing the value of the diversity dividend and the importance of having women and men bringing their diverse perspectives. So that, I think, is a really critical dimension. And what youth are now doing are showing us that intersectionality is so important. If we look just at the binary notions of male and female, which SDG 5 still does, as do the other instruments in the UN, and the measurement of SDG 5, we see many young people now saying, well, we need to look beyond that very narrow categorization in the 2030 agenda, and we need to be looking at intersectionality. So people in their all of their complexities, and hopefully that begins to put more of a human face on people-to-people interaction at a time where it's easy to press a button and high tech can have a drone deliver a weapon, and people are really able to take a step back in othering. And so for me, I think it's so positive to see the way in which young people are really stepping forward, are very conscious of the critical issues that are going on. And of course, we see so many girls leading the Fridays for Future movement, like Greta Thunberg, Shia Bastida, Sophie Hanford, in my own country, New Zealand. We're really seeing young women step up and with their male counterparts and bravely advocate for change. And I would like to finish on the work that we're doing with the UN Foundation Girl Up campaign, where the clubs around the world have actually designed a toolkit which we can make available on the Global Governance Forum website. And that toolkit encourages girls engaging with the UN Foundation to get their male counterparts on board and to advocate for change. So really learning those important skills at a young age of advocating for positive change and then stepping up into those roles as they come of age to really begin to shift our future. And I would finish by saying, I love Christiana Figueres' notion of stubborn optimism, and the recent speech by Kristalina Georgieva about building forward better. And I think Augusto fully engaging youth and women to make sure that we can achieve the kind of future that I know we all aspire to, and really operate with this notion of interdependence that the pandemic has so sheeted home. We are a very big footprint on a very small planet, and we all need to be able to work together compassionately and with care, kindness, and strength to make sure that we can achieve that outcome.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.